Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Time Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to take a couple of minutes of your time. I've mentioned recently the partnership with Sleep Phones, and a reminder that we still have the 10% off offer available to Sleepy Time Tales listeners until the end of September. Using the link in the show notes and the promo code SLEEPYTIME when you purchase, will get you 10% off any purchase of $99.95 or more. That's the price of a wireless pair of Sleep Phones, or like 3 wired ones, so you can buy a whole bunch for the family if everyone is struggling. Then they also have accessories and cool bands and stuff like that, so you can get a few nice odds and ends. So a reminder, using the link in the show notes and the promo code SLEEPYTIME at checkout will get you that special offer. If you'd like to support Sleepy Time Tales more directly, you can, of course, as always, sign up on the Patreon for monthly support. To get, and not only that, but you get some cool rewards depending on the level at which you sign up. Or if you want to make a once-off contribution, you can throw a little something in the tip jar up on the website. There is also the store up on TeePublic. I've got some new designs coming up fairly soon, including some Halloween-themed ones. So that should be fun. Seasonal stuff. And a lot of it also isn't actually Sleepy Time Tales branded, so you can get cool stuff, support the show, and not have to explain to people that you're not comfortable what Sleepy Time Tales is. And another way to help the show is simply to spread the word. If you know someone else who struggles to sleep and you think this might be helpful for them, just let them know. And if you do it on social media, make sure to tag me in, please. That's at Sleepy Time Tales on both Instagram and Twitter. And I'm going to leave it there. Just a quick shout out to the music, which as always is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiko. You can find their work on their website at loyaltyfreakmusic.com. Thanks for taking the time. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Time Tales? What is it for? What is this strange thing, this strange idea, this podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to? In this 21st century, 2022, full of stress and anxieties, lack of sleep is a health crisis. And this is a podcast intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, mind spinning and emotions in turmoil, with the anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m.? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Time Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night, or sometimes background noise or simply company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. The primary idea is that it gives you something to focus on, a story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties, to give you just enough to focus on, not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep when it comes for you. But maybe you need something a bit different. Maybe you just need some kind of background noise. Some people like white noise, sound of the ocean, wind in the trees, sound of rain. Maybe just some boring dude droning on in the background. But as you listen, please make sure you don't try force the sleep. As I'm talking, just keep a light mental grip on the thread of my voice and allow the need for sleep to come for you. Now, obviously, I'm hoping that you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode. But it's important that you don't feel pressurized. It may not work on the first night. It may take a couple of nights for you to get used to listening to my voice. Maybe my accent is strange to you. Maybe the idea of trusting someone to talk to you while you're sleeping is a bit of an odd one. Or maybe, at first at least, one episode isn't long enough. Or maybe your problem isn't so much going to sleep. Maybe you go to sleep alright, but you find yourself waking up in the middle of the night. What I recommend, because it's what works for me, is to let the podcast run all night. In your podcatcher of choice, download a whole bunch of episodes, enough to run through. Put them all in a playlist, and then when you go to sleep, just let them go. That way, if you wake up and you're struggling to go back to sleep again, you can just carry on listening and go straight back out again. And you can even do the same thing if you're someone who wakes up a little bit before your alarm, 60 minutes or as little as 30 minutes. It may sound pointless. What is the use of going to sleep 30 minutes before the alarm? But I've got to tell you, and I've had people thank me for telling you about this, is that I find if that happens to me, that 30 minutes before the alarm is the most relaxing part of my night. There's something about it. I think allowing yourself the complete relaxation at that point, that's just satisfying on a whole new level. But it's important as you listen that you just try to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this may seem strange to you, so give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you, to create a safe space, a cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course, you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. We return this week to Little Women. No one would own that they were tired of the experiment. But by Friday night, each acknowledged to herself that she was glad the week was nearly done. Hoping to impress the lesson more deeply, Mrs. March, who had a good deal of humor, resolved to finish off the trial in an appropriate manner. So she gave Hannah a holiday and let the girls enjoy the full effect of the play system. When they got up on Saturday morning, there was no fire in the kitchen, no breakfast in the dining room, and no mother anywhere to be seen. "Mercy on us, what has happened?" cried Jo, staring about her in dismay. Meg ran upstairs and soon came back again, looking relieved, but rather bewildered and a little ashamed. "Mother isn't sick, only very tired. And she says she is going to stay quietly in her room all day and let us do the best we can." "It's a very queer thing for her to do. She doesn't act a bit like herself. But she says it has been a hard week for her, so we mustn't grumble, but take care of ourselves." "That's easy enough, and I like the idea. I'm aching for something to do. That is, some new amusement, you know," added Jo quickly. In fact, it was an immense relief to them all to have a little work, and they took hold with a will, but soon realized the truth of Hannah's saying, "Housekeeping ain't no joke." There was plenty of food in the larder, and while Beth and Amy set the table, Meg and Jo got breakfast, wondering as they did why servants ever talked about hard work. "I shall take some up to Mother, though she said we were not to think of her, for she'd take care of herself," said Meg. who presided and felt quite matronly behind the teapot. So a tray was fitted out before anyone began and taken up with the cook's compliments. The boiled tea was very bitter, the omelette scorched, and the biscuits speckled with saleratus. But Mrs. March received her repast with thanks and laughed heartily over it after Joe was gone. Poor little souls, they will have a hard time, I'm afraid. But they won't suffer and will do them good, she said, producing the more palatable viands with which she had provided herself, and disposing of the bad breakfast, so that their feelings might not be hurt. A motherly little deception for which they were grateful. Many were the complaints below, and great the chagrin of the head cook at her failures. Never mind. I'll get the dinner and be servant. You be mistress. Keep your hands nice, see company, and give orders, said Joe, who knew still less than Meg about culinary affairs. This obliging offer was gladly accepted, and Margaret retired to the parlour, which she hastily put in order, by whisking the litter under the sofa and shutting the blinds to save the trouble of dusting. Joe, with perfect faith in her own powers and a friendly desire to make up the quarrel, immediately put a note in the office inviting Laurie to dinner. You'd better see what you have before you think of having company, said Meg, when informed of the hospitable but rash act. Oh, there's corned beef and plenty of potatoes. And I shall get some asparagus and lobster for a relish, as Hannah says. We'll have lettuce and make a salad. I don't know how, but the book tells. I'll have blancmange and strawberries for dessert. And coffee too, if you want to be elegant. Don't try too many messes, Joe, for you can't make anything but gingerbread and molasses candy fit to eat. I wash my hands of the dinner party, and since you have asked Laurie on your own responsibility, you may just take care of him. I don't want you to do anything but be civil to him and help to the pudding. You'll give me your advice if I get in a muddle, won't you? Asked Joe, rather hurt. Yes, but I don't know much, except about bread and a few trifles. You had better ask Mother's leave before you order anything, returned Meg prudently. Of course I shall, I'm not a fool. And Joe went off in a huff at the doubts expressed of her powers. Get what you like and don't disturb me. I'm going out to dinner and can't worry about things at home, said Mrs. March, when Joe spoke to her. I never enjoyed housekeeping and I'm going to take a vacation today. And read, write, go visiting and amuse myself. The unusual spectacle of her busy mother rocking comfortably and reading early in the morning made Joe feel as if some unnatural phenomenon had occurred, for an eclipse, an earthquake, or a volcanic eruption would hardly have seemed stranger. Everything is out of sorts somehow, she said to herself, going downstairs. There's Beth crying. That's a sure sign that something is wrong in this family. If Amy is bothering, I'll shake her. Feeling very much out of sorts herself, Jo hurried into the parlour to find Beth sobbing over Pip, the canary who lay dead in the cage with his little claws pathetically extended, as if imploring for food, for want of which he had died. It's all my fault, I forgot him. There isn't a seed or a drop left. Oh, Pip, oh, Pip. How could I be so cruel to you? Cried Beth, taking the poor thing in her hands and trying to restore him. Joe peeped into his half-open eye, felt his little heart, and finding him stiff and cold, shook her head and offered her domino box for a coffin. put him in the oven and maybe he'll get warm and revive, said Amy, hopefully. He's been starved, and he shan't be baked now he's dead. I'll make him a shroud and he shall be buried in the garden, and I'll never have another bird, never, my pup, for I'm too bad to own one, murmured Beth, sitting on her floor with her pet folded in her hands. The funeral shall be this afternoon, and we will all go. Now don't cry, Bethy. It's a pity, but nothing goes right this week. And Pip has had the worst of the experiment. Make the shroud and lay him in my box, and after the dinner party, we will have a nice little funeral, said Jo, beginning to feel as if she had undertaken a good deal. Leaving the others to console Beth, she departed to the kitchen, which was in a most discouraging state of confusion. Putting on a big apron, she fell to work and got the dishes piled up ready for washing when she discovered that the fire was out. Here's a sweet prospect, muttered Jo, slamming the stove door open and poking vigorously among the cinders. Having rekindled the fire, she thought she would go to market while the water heated. The walk revived her spirits, and flattering herself that she had made good bargains, she trudged home again, after buying a very young lobster, some very old asparagus, and 2 boxes of acid strawberries. By the time she got cleared up, the dinner arrived, and the stove was red hot. Hannah had left a pan of bread to rise. Meg had worked it up early, set it on the hearth for a second rising, and forgotten it. Meg was entertaining Sally Gardner in the parlor when the door flew open and a flowery, crocky, flushed and disheveled figure appeared, demanding tartly, I say, isn't the bread risen enough when it runs over the pans? Sally began to laugh, but Meg nodded and lifted her eyebrows as high as they would go, which caused the apparition to vanish and put the sour bread into the oven without further delay. Mrs. March went out after peeping here and there to see how matters went, also saying a word of comfort to Beth, who sat making a winding sheet, while the dear departed lay in a state in the domino box. A strange sense of helplessness fell upon the girls as the grey bonnet vanished around the corner, and despair seized them when a few minutes later Miss Crocker appeared and said she'd come to dinner. Now this lady was a thin yellow spinster with a sharp nose and inquisitive eyes who saw everything and gossiped about all she saw. They disliked her, but had been taught to be kind to her, simply because she was old and poor and had few friends. So Meg gave her the easy chair and tried to entertain her, while she asked questions, criticized everything, and told stories of the people whom she knew. Language cannot describe the anxieties, experiences, and exertions which Jo underwent that morning, and the dinner she served up became a standing joke. Fearing to ask any more advice, she did her best alone and discovered that something more than energy and goodwill is necessary to make a cook. She boiled the asparagus for an hour and was grieved to find the heads cooked off and the stalks harder than ever. The bread burned black, for the salad dressing so aggravated her that she could not make it fit to eat. The lobster was a scarlet mystery to her, but she hammered and poked till it was unshelled, and its meager proportions concealed in a grove of lettuce leaves. The potatoes had to be hurried, not to keep the asparagus waiting, and were not done at the last. The blancmange was lumpy, and the strawberries not as ripe as they looked, having been skillfully deconed. Well, they can eat beef and bread and butter, if they are hungry, Only it's mortifying to have to spend your whole morning for nothing, thought Joe, as she rang the bell half an hour later than usual, and stood hot, tired, and dispirited, surveying the feast spread before Laurie, accustomed to all sorts of elegance, and Miss Crocker, whose tackling tongue would report them far and wide. Poor Joe would gladly have gone under the table, as one thing after another was tasted and left. While Amy giggled, Meg looked distressed, Miss Crocker pursed her lips, and Laurie talked and laughed with all his might to give a cheerful tone to the festive scene. Joe's one strong point was the fruit, for she had sugared it well, and had a pitcher of rich cream to eat with it. Her hot cheeks cooled a trifle, and she drew a long breath as the pretty glass plates went round, and everyone looked graciously at the little rosy islands floating in a sea of cream. Miss Crocker tasted first, made a wry face, and drank some water hastily. Joe, who refused, thinking there might not be enough, for they dwindled sadly after the picking over, glanced at Laurie. But he was eating away manfully, though there was a slight pucker about his mouth, and he kept his eye fixed on his plate. Amy, who was fond of delicate fare, took a heaping spoonful, choked, hid her face in her napkin, and left the table precipitately. "Oh, what is it?" exclaimed Joe, trembling. "Salt instead of sugar, and the cream is sour," replied Meg with a tragic gesture. Joe uttered a groan and fell back in her chair, remembering that she had given a hasty last powdering to the berries out of one of the two boxes on the kitchen table, and had neglected to put the milk in the refrigerator. She turned scarlet and was on the verge of crying when she met Laurie's eyes, which would look merry in spite of his heroic efforts. The comical side of the affair suddenly struck her, and she laughed till the tears ran down her cheeks. So did everyone else. Even Croaker, as the girls called the old lady. And the unfortunate dinner ended gaily, with bread and butter, olives and fun. "I haven't strength of mind to clear up now, so we will sober ourselves with a funeral," said Joe as they rose. And Miss Crocker made ready to go, being eager to tell the new story at another friend's dinner table. They did sober themselves for Beth's sake. Laurie dug a grave under the ferns in the grove. Little Pip was laid in with many tears by his tender-hearted mistress and covered with moss, while a wreath of violets and chickweed was hung on the stone which bore his epitaph, composed by Joe while she struggled with the dinner. "Here lies Pip March, who died the 7th of June, loved and lamented sore, and not forgotten soon." At the conclusion of the ceremonies, Beth retired to her room, overcome with emotion and lobster. But there was no place for repose, for the beds were not made, and she found her grief much assuaged by beating up the pillows and putting things in order. Meg helped Joe clear away the remains of the feast, which took half the afternoon, and left them so tired that they agreed to be contented with tea and toast for supper. Laurie took Amy to drive, which was a deed of charity, for the sour cream seemed to have had a bad effect upon her temper. Mrs. March came home to find the three older girls hard at work in the middle of the afternoon, and a glance at the closet gave her an idea of the success of one part of the experiment. Before the housewives could rest, several people called, and there was a scramble to get ready to see them. Then tea must be got, errands done, and one or two necessary bits of sewing neglected until the last minute. As twilight fell, dewy and still, one by one they gathered on the porch where the June roses were budding beautifully, and each groaned or sighed as she sat down, as if tired or troubled. "What a dreadful day this has been," began Joe, usually the first to speak. "It has seemed shorter than usual, but so uncomfortable," said Meg. "Not a bit like home," added Amy. "It can't seem so without Mommy and little Pip," sighed Beth, glancing with full eyes at the empty cage above her head. "Here's Mother dear, and you shall have another bird tomorrow if you want it." As she spoke, Mrs. March came and took her place among them, looking as if her holiday had not been much pleasanter than theirs. "Are you satisfied with your experiment, girls? Or do you want another week of it?" she asked, as Beth nestled up to her and the rest turned towards her with brightening faces, as flowers turned towards the sun. "I don't," cried Joe decidedly. "Nor I," echoed the others. "You think then that it is better to have a few duties and live a little for others, do you?" "Lounging and larking don't pay," observed Joe, shaking her head. "I'm tired of it, and mean to go to work at something right off." "Suppose you learn plain cooking. That's a useful accomplishment, which no woman should be without," said Mrs. March, laughing inaudibly at the recollection of Joe's dinner party, for she had met Miss Crocker and heard her account of it. "Mother, did you go away and let everything be, just to see how we'd get on?" cried Meg, who had suspicions all day. "Yes. I wanted you to see how the comfort of all depends on each doing her share faithfully. While Hannah and I did your work, you got on pretty well, though I don't think you were very happy or amiable. So I thought, as a little lesson, I would show you what happens when everyone thinks only of herself. Don't you feel that it is pleasanter to help one another, to have daily duties which make leisure sweet when it comes, and to bear and forbear that home shall be comfortable and lovely to us all?" "We do, Mother, we do," cried the girls. "Then let me advise you to take up your little burdens again, for though they seem heavy sometimes, they are good for us, and lighten as we learn to carry them. Work is wholesome and there's plenty for everyone. It keeps us from ennui and mischief, is good for health and spirits, and gives us a sense of power and independence better than money or fashion. We'll work like bees and love it too, see if we don't," said Joe. "I'll learn plain cooking for my holiday task, and the next dinner party I have shall be a success. I'll make the set of shirts for Father, instead of letting you do it, Mommy. I can and I will, though I'm not fond of sewing. That will be better than fussing over my own things, which are plenty nice enough as they are," said Meg. "I'll do my lessons every day and not spend so much time with my music and dolls. I'm a stupid thing and ought to be studying, not playing," was Beth's resolution, while Amy followed the example by heroically declaring, "I shall learn to make buttonholes and attend to my parts of speech." "Very good. Then I'm quite satisfied with the experiment, and fancy that we shall not have to repeat it. Only don't go to the other extreme and delve like slaves. Have regular hours for work and play, make each day both useful and pleasant, and prove that you understand the worth of time by employing it well. Then youth will be delightful, old age will bring few regrets, and life becomes a beautiful success in spite of poverty. We'll remember, Mother." And they did. Chapter 12. Camp Lawrence. Beth was postmistress. For, being most at home, she could attend to it regularly and dearly liked the daily task of unlocking the little door and distributing the mail. One July day she came in with her hands full, and went about the house, leaving letters and parcels like the penny post. "Here's your posy, Mother. Laurie never forgets that," she said, putting the fresh nosegay in the vase that stood in Mommy's corner, and was kept supplied by the affectionate boy. "Miss Meg March, one letter and a glove," continued Beth, delivering the articles to her sister, who sat near her mother, stitching wristbands. "Why, I left a pair over there, and here is only one," said Meg, looking at the grey cotton glove. "Didn't you drop the other in the garden?" "No, I'm sure I didn't, but there was only one in the office. I hate to have odd gloves. Never mind, the other may be found. My letter is only a translation of the German song I wanted. I think Mr. Brooks did it, but this isn't Laurie's writing." Mrs. March glanced at Meg, who was looking very pretty in her gingham morning gown, with the little curls blowing about her forehead, and very womanly as she sat sewing at her little work table, full of tidy white rolls, so unconscious of the thought in her mother's mind as she sewed and sang, while her fingers flew and her thoughts were busied with girlish fancies, as innocent and fresh as the pansies in her belt, that Mrs. March smiled and was satisfied. "Two letters for Dr. Joe, a book and a funny old hat, which covered the whole post office and stuck outside," said Beth, laughing as she went into the study where Joe sat writing. "What a sly fellow Laurie is. I said I wished bigger hats were the fashion because I burn my face every hot day. He said, why mind the fashion? Wear a big hat and be comfortable. I said I would if I had one, and he has sent me this to try me. I'll wear it for fun and show him I don't care for the fashion." And hanging the antique broad brim on a bust of Plato, Joe read her letters. One from her mother made her cheeks glow and her eyes full, for it said to her, "My dear, I write a little word to tell you with how much satisfaction I watch your efforts to control your temper. You say nothing about your trials, failures, or successes, and think perhaps that no one sees them but the friend whose help you daily ask. If I may trust the well-worn cover of your guidebook, I too have seen them all, and heartily believe in the sincerity of your resolution, since it begins to bear fruit. Go on, dear, patiently and bravely, and always believe that no one sympathizes more tenderly with you than your loving mother." That does me good. That's worth millions of money and pecks of praise. Oh, Mommy, I do try. I will keep on trying and not get tired, since I have you to help me. Laying her head on her arms, Jo wet her little romance with a few happy tears, for she had thought that no one saw and appreciated her efforts to be good, and this assurance was doubly precious, doubly encouraging, because unexpected and from the person whose commendation she most valued. Feeling stronger than ever to meet and subdue her, Apollyon, she pinned the note inside her frock, as a shield and a reminder lest she be taken unaware, and proceeded to open her other letter, quite ready for either good or bad news. In a big dashing hand, Laurie wrote, "Dear Joe, what ho? Some English girls and boys are coming to see me tomorrow, and I want to have a jolly time. If it's fine, I'm going to pitch my tent in Longmeadow and row up the whole crew to lunch and croquet. Have a fire, make messes, and all sorts of larks. They're nice people and like such things. Brooke will go to keep us boys ready, and Kate Fawn will play propriety for the girls. I want you all to come. Can't let Beth off at any price, and nobody shall worry her. Don't bother about rations, I'll see to that and everything else. Only do come, there's a good fellow. In a tearing hurry, yours ever, Laurie." "Here's richness," cried Joe, flying in to tell the news to Meg. "Of course we can go, Mother. It will be such a help to Laurie, for I can row. And Megsy to the lunch. And the children be useful in some way. I hope the Vaughans are not fine grown-up people. Do you know anything about them, Joe?" asked Meg. "Only that there are four of them. Kate is older than you. Fred and Frank, twins about my age, and a little girl, Grace, who is 9 or 10. Laurie knew them abroad and liked the boys. I fancied, from the way he primed up his mouth in speaking of her, that he didn't admire Kate much. I'm so glad my French print is clean. It's just the thing and so becoming," observed Meg complacently. "Have you anything decent, Joe?" "Scarlet and grey boating suit, good enough for me. I shall row and tramp about, so I don't want any starch to think of. You'll come, Betty? If you won't let any boys talk to me." "Not a boy." "I like to please Laurie, and I'm not afraid of Mr. Brooke. He is so kind. But I don't want to play or sing or say anything. I'll work hard and not trouble anyone, and you'll take care of me, Joe, so I'll go." "That's my good girl. You do try to fight off your shyness, and I love you for it. Fighting faults isn't easy, as I know, and a cheery word kind of gives a lift. Thank you, Mother." And Joe gave the thin cheek a grateful kiss, more precious to Mrs. March than if it had been given back the rosy roundness of her youth. "I had a box of chocolate drops and the picture I wanted to copy," said Amy, showing her mail. "And I got a note from Mr. Lawrence, asking me to come over and play to him tonight, before the lamps are lighted, and I shall go," added Beth, whose friendship with the old gentleman prospered finely. "Now let's fly around and do double duty today, so that we can play tomorrow with free minds," said Joe, preparing to replace her pen with a broom. When the sun peeped into the girls' room early next morning to promise them a fine day, she saw a comical sight. Each had made such preparation for the fete as seemed necessary and proper. Meg had an extra row of little curl papers across her forehead. Joe had copiously anointed her afflicted face with cold cream. Beth had taken Joanna to bed with her to atone for the approaching separation. And Amy had capped the climax by putting a clothespin on her nose to uplift the offending feature. It was one of the kind artists used to hold the paper on their drawing boards, therefore quite appropriate and effective for the purpose it was now being put. This funny spectacle appeared to amuse the sun, for he burst out with such radiance that Joe woke up and roused her sisters by a hearty laugh at Amy's ornament. Sunshine and laughter were good omens for a pleasure party, and soon a lively bustle began in both houses. Beth, who was ready first, kept reporting what went on next door, and enlivened her sister's toilets by frequent telegrams from the window. "There goes the man with the tent. I see Mr. Barker doing up the lunch in a hamper and a great basket. Now Mr. Lawrence is looking up at the sky and the weathercock. I wish he would go too. There's Laurie looking like a sailor. Nice boy. Oh, mercy me. Has a carriage full of people. A tall lady, a little girl, and two dreadful boys. One is lame, poor thing. He's got a crutch. Laurie didn't tell us that. Be quick, girls. It's getting late. Why, there's Ned Moffat, I do declare. Meg, isn't that the man who bowed to you one day when we were shopping?" "So it is. How queer that he should come. I thought he was at the mountains. There is Sally. I'm glad she got back in time. Am I all right, Joe?" cried Meg in a flutter. "A regular daisy. Hold up your dress and put your hat on straight. It looks sentimental tipped that way and will fly off at the first puff. Now then, come on. Oh, Joe, you are not going to wear that awful hat. It's too absurd. You shall not make a guy of yourself, remonstrated Meg, as Joe tied down with a red ribbon the broad-rimmed, old-fashioned leghorn Laurie had sent for a joke. I just will, though, for it's capital. So shady, light, and big. It will make fun, and I don't mind being a guy if I'm comfortable. With that, Joe marched straight away, and the rest followed. A bright little band of sisters, all looking their best in summer suits, with happy faces under the jaunty hat brims. Laurie manned to meet and present them to his friends in the most cordial manner. The lawn was the reception room, and for several minutes a lively scene was enacted there. Meg was grateful to see that Miss Kate, though 20, was dressed with a simplicity which American girls could do well to imitate, and who was much flattered by Mr. Ned's assurances that he came especially to see her. Joe understood why Laurie primmed up his mouth when speaking of Kate. For the young lady had a standoffish, don't touch me air, which contrasted strongly with the free and easy demeanor of the other girls. Beth took an observation of the new boys and decided that the lame one was not dreadful, but gentle and feeble, and she would be kind to him on that account. Amy found Grace a well-mannered, merry little person, and after staring dumbly at one another for a few minutes, they suddenly became very good friends. And I think I'm going to leave it at that. As always, if you'd like to pick up where we've left off, you can find the original on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week, but make sure to subscribe or follow so that you get the new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked on the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.